You. So tonight we have Christy Mack with almost 17 months of sobriety. I asked her what her secret to sobriety is, and she said keeping spiritually fit and helping others, and if it wasn't for God, she wouldn't be standing here today. She knows that's a fact. In regards to spirituality, she shared some information with me, and she said that she always had a God in her life, so finding God, like some of us had to, wasn't an issue for her. She always had God there with her. And she said surrendering was a pivotal moment in her sobriety. I asked her what a roadblock to recovery for her was and how she stayed on the path. She said, life in general is a roadblock. And she said, sometimes you just have to give it to God. And she says, it never goes well for me when I'm in charge. It's a fact for a lot of us. She said that she fought the process of recovery so hard for so long that she was given the gift of desperation. And she's just kind of said, like, Lord, just tell me what to do and I'll do it. She is a person of service. She sponsors three women. She tries to be a mentor by leading by example. She went to New Hope. And she says that when she went to New Hope, she learned three things about herself. One, that she was an alcoholic. Two, that she had taken her last drink. And three, that she needed help. Her advice to the newcomer is to be open-minded and willing. Thank you so much for letting me be of service. I'm going to go ahead and introduce our speaker for the evening, Christy Mack from Visalia with almost 17 months. Hi, I'm Christy Mack. I'm an alcoholic. I'm tall. That's good. Yeah. My sober date is September 27, 2018, and that was the day or the day before, night before I took my last drink. And I knew that night that would be it for me. I am here just by the grace of God. I know that He orchestrated my recovery because I could not, you know, He did for me what I couldn't do for myself because I was in no shape to get to where I got to get the help. I'm a little bit nervous. That's not a normal feeling for me. How it was, you know, I want to talk more a message, I guess, than my mess. If you're here, you kind of know my mess, kind of the different day, same story, you know, or different experiences. I was raised in a really good household. My parents are still married. I'm the oldest. I had nothing traumatic happen in my childhood. My dog died. That was like the worst thing that ever happened to me. My mom stayed home. Funny thing about, I mean, it's not funny my dog died, but my first rehab, they were really big on getting out some childhood trauma, you know, and people have these horrific stories, and I'm sitting there, and they thought that I had repressed something, you know. They'd put me in the middle of the mesh pot and be like, tell us about your childhood. So finally, I was just like, my dog died when I was like 8, and it was really horrible, and Mary went blind at Little House in the Prairie, and every time I got a fever, I thought I was going to go blind. I mean, that was like it, you know. I was a happy, really easy kid. I do remember my family's real type A, and I'm not in most areas. And I never didn't fit in or anything, like in a weird way, but I do remember being like, how did I get born in this family? Like, what's the big deal all the time? And they called me the kid with no pulse. This is Christy. She's our kid with no pulse. You know, like care about something because I was always like, okay, you know. And that really bugged them. And it still does. Anyways, you know, I had a good childhood. My dad is a master, you know, our environment about drinking. He's a master storyteller. He loves to entertain like a little small group of people. And he would tell us these stories. He had a pretty colorful childhood. Just imagine Oki, like in Oklahoma. And they lived, my great-grandpa was paralyzed in a racing accident.
and my great grandma, and they were both really bad alcoholics. And they bought the grandpa a monkey to keep him entertained. And the monkey was also alcoholic. So I come from a line of alcoholic animals and a pill popper and a nicotine addict. So my dad would tell us these really funny stories. I mean, what's funnier than a drunk grandma and a drunk monkey? And, you know, just really funny stories about this monkey. And at the end, he would say, oh, but nothing good comes of drinking. And after, you know, reflecting on my life, growing up in recovery, I realized the obsession to drink actually started for me really young, because he would say that nothing good comes from drinking. And I can remember being little and a really good kid and going, sounds like a lot of fun. Comes from drinking. He stopped drinking. My mom was 17 when she had me, and my dad was 19. And he got in a bad motorcycle. He stayed partying. He got in a bad motorcycle accident and stopped drinking. And I've really only seen my dad drink a few times. So in my... The message that I took away from that was that that's what you do when you're in high school and college, and then you don't, you know, you grow up. So it never was in my head that I wasn't going to drink. The magic age for me was 16. I was like, I'm going to be able to drive, drink, and get a boyfriend. In fact, I didn't sign that just say no pledge when I was like 9, because I didn't want to lie. And I was like, yeah, when I'm 16, I'm probably going to drink, you know. And I was telling kids on the playground, and they went and told. And so my teacher calls me and is like, Christy, what's this here? You know, I heard that you're not going to say no. Are you doing drug? You know, and I'm like, no, when I'm 16, I might. I don't want to tell a lie and sign the pledge. She's like, well, you're not going to get, you know, your little bag of just say no pencils and stickers and all that stuff, which for me, I really like that stuff. It was a big deal for me to be like, yeah, but I don't want to lie. Yeah, and I didn't sign it. And I was like 10. And then I was scared shitless for like 2 weeks that she was going to tell my parents. But anyway, so we didn't really have alcohol at our house. We had a cupboard above the fridge where all the alcohol was. For, you know, my dad had a company, so people would give him Crown Royal in the purple bag. And that cupboard comes into my story later. And that's just where it was. My family drank. Everything was really hidden from me. I now know as an adult that there was a lot of alcoholism in my family. But it, you know, never was in my, I never really knew, you know. It's like, yeah, there's a barbecue, people are drinking beer. You know, my parents don't. That's, you know, I really didn't think anything. When I'm 16, I can. I don't know where that number came from. But I almost made it. I drank for the first time when I was 15. It was Sadie Hawkins dance. I was with an older guy, older people, party crowd, and I had so much fun. I hear a lot of alcoholics say that they didn't fit in, and then they drank and made them fit in, or they felt like something was missing, and all of a sudden, that really wasn't my story. Ego, when the book talks, I left my book over there, but when the book talks about it, ego, you know, that was me. I already thought I was really cool, and when I drank, I became more cool. And I quickly fell into like the party crowd in high school, you know, the older people, and nothing was off limits. Other substances came into play really quickly, like in that first week after I drank the first time, and I found that anything that made me drink more, longer, and stay up longer and be able to party all weekend, I really liked. And we were really big. If we couldn't get our hands on that, we would snort mini thins. And I don't know, I'm aging myself now. Don't try this at home, kids. They've taken up the cocaine out of mini thins. But back in the day, does anyone else remember that? They were like, they had like drugs in them, you know? It was like over the counter coke, uppers, you know? And I liked those. And I was just out of control. And my family, they tried so hard. I was the oldest. They were really strict. I was always in trouble. Something that I think is not super normal. When I look back, there was red flags. My dad's answer was always manual labor if I got caught drunk. And he had a road construction business. And I would pre-plan. Like, I knew that my ass was going to come home or not, be in trouble, get caught drunk, and have to do yard work or pick up the walnuts or whatever it was going to be. So I would go, and, like, throughout the week, I would, like, find the perfect opportunity to get some alcohol from that cupboard and hide it out in the yard, because I knew come Saturday morning at 6 a.m. my dad was going to be like, you play hard, you pay hard. And nothing fazed me. I had no pulse. I was like, okay. I mean, I knew I was going to have to, you know, he's going to get me out of bed. I was going to be hungover, and I was going to go pick up the walnuts. And if I hurry and do it, can I go out tonight? And he's like, you can't, you know, do that. And there I would be, all the while, you know, drinking by myself. My mom said that one time they were watching me, and I was out there. I had my bathing suit on and my Discman member. I'm aging myself again, but they were like big, like hooked to it. I've been taking shots all day, and I'm like dancing. Like, it was supposed to be a punishment, and I'm like making it fun. And my dad was like, is she retarded and we don't know it? Like, what's wrong with her? I was just pretty much out of control. High school, I basically was loaded or grounded and doing manual labor. One time he decided I was going to be the flag girl for his construction. He sent me out of town with strict orders. I couldn't hang out with the crew, you know, after work. So we're up in San Mateo. That was the best thing that ever happened. It was supposed to be a punishment, you know, and I'm like, this is, they gave me a walkie-talkie so I could, like, be crazy and fun, you know, on the walkie-talkie. Party all night after with the guys, you know, and I'm like, and he had to pay me, and I'm like, good, like $25 an hour. Excuse me. And I was like, this is the best punishment ever. Like, how can I get my best friend in this gig? And he caught me. He drove up, and no one knew he was coming. And, you know, I'm out in the jacuzzi partying with, you know, all the crew. So I got fired from that gig. But, you know, they tried everything. You know, I wasn't allowed to drink. But fast forward college, I went away to Cal Poly, and that just trend continued. I was on the water ski team there, which was just a huge party. It's like, let's give a bunch of 19-year-olds a cabin at Lake Nocimino, some boats, alcohol and drugs, and, well, you know, what could go wrong? I'm lucky to be alive over a lot of the stuff that I did. Drunk, you know, boats, and, you know, doesn't mix with alcohol, and we were just wild, you know, just, you know, I know, let's barefoot ski, topless, with no life vest, you know, that sounds like a great idea. My feet would be all cut up, and I always was, like, trying to be the center. I like to be the center of the, you know, the center of attention. As wild, as obnoxious as I could be, the more fun I thought I had. And there's, like, usually one of me. There's probably one of me down in a bar right now, you know, up on the bar being obnoxious. So I ended up moving back. I met who ended up being my husband, and we dated for about a year and a half, 2 years, and that was just a big party relationship. During all this time, by the way, I always got good grades. You know, nothing ever happened, because I had a lot of near misses, like almost DUIs, almost crashes, waking up in really weird places, but nothing happened to me. So, you know, nothing really, even when I look back now, that was just kind of a fun time, but I do see the red flags. I ended up getting pregnant at the end of, it was like the last semester of college, and we decided to get married. And that, I stopped drinking. You know, the day I found out, I was like, okay, like my life plan, you know, I partied in high school. Now I'm a grown up, and now I'm, you know, and he didn't really have that life plan. You know, right off the bat, things weren't really that good. And, he stayed partying. That's his story, but I've been on both ends of the spectrum. I've been married to an alcoholic addict and then became one myself. And so I started lying. I didn't want anyone to know what my life was really like at home, you know? You know, he didn't come home most of the time, you know, and I just didn't want his family, my friends to know that I had, like, gotten myself in this position, you know, cheating, you know, just all that stuff. And I can remember just thinking, oh my God, how did this happen to me? You know, why? And I just was a mom. I had 4 kids in 5 and a half years, so I was pretty busy. And And that part of my life was fun, but I was really sad. I, like, didn't understand, you know, why I wasn't good enough to stay faithful to come home. I tried everything that you could do, you know, but I was really lonely and sad for, I want to say I tried for, like, 5 years. And then I was pissed and was like, whatever. And then I just was numb, you know, at that point, just numb. And you can count on, you know, both hands the times I drank during in 10 years. I was busy, you know, my birthday, a wedding, just an event. But every time was a huge binge. Like, I was pissed when it was time to go home. I drank when I got home. You know, once the switch was turned on, I just don't like to stop. I can pinpoint when I started drinking alcoholically. Well, back up a little bit. So I went back to work full time, was going to school, raising kids, 4 kids alone. They were busy. I have no help, and things were unraveling. And I couldn't keep it together. And my kids were starting to figure out that it's not normal. Our household isn't normal to not have a dad home. And they started catching on. They knew what marijuana smelled like. They were in seventh grade, you know, and they're like, does dad smoke pot? And I'm like, you're going to have to, I don't think so. Let's go. You know, I just was trying to cover all that up, you know, and I was really busy, and I ended up going to, I'm like, oh, I need to lose some weight. And I went to, like, a quack doctor at the time. Phentermine was really in, which, if you don't know what that is, it's just a, like, stimulant to help you lose weight. And the first day I took it as directed in the morning so you can sleep at night. And I'm like, oh, wow. I had so much energy. I got my homework done, their homework done, dinner, bath. And so I was like, if one pill in the morning gives me this much energy, snorting 5 at night is going to really help, right? So that's what I started doing. And so, I mean, I was getting that shit done, you know, but I was burning the candle at both ends, you know, and that's when my life started to unravel. Like, I couldn't keep the facade going. You know, I've been doing this for like 15 years, and I was tired. And I ended up right at this time, catching my husband. I don't like to say too much, but I'd always assumed that he was cheating with women and that it was free, but that apparently wasn't the case. And it was just so disgusting to me. And I was like, okay, it's done. I throw the towel in. I don't want to feel this. And I'm getting drunk. So I had that same cupboard that my parents had that I didn't drink. And I got drunk that night. And didn't stop. I just started drinking every night. From that point on, I went through a bad divorce. It was really ugly. It was stressful, ugly. I kind of kept that going for like a year. I was drinking wine every night, binging on the weekends a little bit. You know, then my weekends end up, you know, becoming longer, like Thursday through Sunday. And that mental obsession just kind of clicked in, you know. I was hiding it. I started making an ass out of myself everywhere I went. I stopped getting invited places with, like, longtime friends. And I was starting, I mean, I already was sick. I was sick before I became an alcoholic or drank alcoholically, I now know. But I was like, they're just jealous because I still know how to have fun. You know, I just was sick thinking, you know, and I'm like, fine, I'll just drink alone, you know, and I was hiding it. My kids started saying, Mom, you need to stop. I'm like, everyone drinks wine at night, you know. And my life just kind of started falling apart. I lost my job indirectly because of drinking. I'm a teacher, and I was supposed to take a class. Well, I'm drinking every night, you know, and when I lost it, it was in the middle of the school year. And I, you know, that ego, you know, I was like, oh, good luck running this school without me. You know, like, you know, I do everything here, you know, it's like, whatever. I mean, I literally was like, felt so entitled, like, you know, I wasn't doing what I was supposed to do, you know. And then I pretended that I had the job still because I didn't want anyone to know. And I would get up and get dressed like I was going to work and take kids to school and go park at a park and drink all day. I kept that going for a while, you know, just the lies, and the lies would just come so easy. Just everything was a lie, you know. And I'd been doing it already for 15 years for my husband, you know, and now it was me. My family ended up doing an intervention. Has anyone had an intervention? Anyone? I'm not a fan. I did not, to this day, I did not like interventions. I figured mine out because everyone was acting all weird, and I drove by, I was already drunk, I drove by my brother's house, and every car of anyone I know ever in the world was parked at my brother's house. Like, looking back now, I'm still like, whose idea was that? I still don't like too many familiar cars in one place. Like, is it Easter or is this a setup? you know, I'm like, okay, oh, you're sober. Oh, they're not here to talk to me. I agreed to go to rehab after that, and I still had insurance, so I went to Beacon House. I didn't know all rehabs weren't like that. I now call it my princess rehab, and I was not an alcoholic, for one. My life was not unmanageable. These people are crazy, and nothing like these people. And I definitely need a break from alcohol, and I think I've taken it too far, but that's it. And that was my attitude there. There were maids and chefs, and I kind of just treated it like I deserve this little 28-day break, you know, like well watching and yoga on the beach, you know. I'm like out there all, you know, this is great, you know, and I would not conform. And I was smarter than the psychiatrist there, and that's why he hated me. And he was like world renowned. They flew him in jets to like talk about recovery, and I'm like, he knows I'm smarter than him, and that's why he pinpoints me and doesn't like me. And as soon as they said that I, you know, that you couldn't ever drink again, I checked out. I was like, yeah, right, these people are crazy. And then they wanted me to talk about my feelings, but I don't think about. Remember, I have no pulse. I don't do that, and I hadn't done that in a really long time. So basically, I dried out there, played the game. That's where I learned to play the rehab game. You know, yeah, I'm doing my stuff. You could get a free sweatshirt. It was a nice one. It was a hoodie. And if you did step one and got a sponsor. And so I lied and was like, yeah, I got a sponsor, Deborah. And you had to show her the number. I'm like, got the area code. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go call her right now. And I'm like, yeah, I did step one and got the sweatshirt. And Deborah followed me all the way back to Visalia. This was up in Monterey, and continued to be my sponsor when I was here, when anyone asked me if I was doing recovery. It's like, yeah, I meet with Deborah. oh my God, yeah, and she lives in Tulare. She was a nurse in Tulare. I mean, these lies just, you know, and I have to go to Tulare, and we're going to two meetings in Starbucks, so I'm going to be gone 5 hours. And that way I could be out drinking for 5 hours. And my daughter, right before I went to my first rehab, my daughter had gone to my brother's to babysit and never came back, and she still hasn't. And she was done. She was embarrassed. I was embarrassing. You know, I was letting, my boys were in high school, and even now they're like, well, we weren't embarrassed. Well, no, because their house was really fun, because everyone could party at my house. I never partied with the kids. I didn't ever cross that line. I would be up in my room, but I let them party. I figured, you know, they should be doing it here, then they're going to be doing it somewhere else, you know, and if they would take me to the store to get more alcohol for me, I'd buy all theirs. You know, I was that parent. Like, I had become that parent that I would never be, you know. But it was, my daughter was a freshman, and that was really embarrassing to her, you know, like all these cool older guys are partying at her house every weekend, you know. But that wasn't my rock bottom when she left. I went to rehab. She didn't come back. I stayed sober for probably 3 months, got another job, got my kids back, got a house right away. And, you know, I was like this. I didn't do any recovery. And I decided, well, I'm not even an alcoholic. I haven't drank in 3 months. And I, you know, really kind of haven't really wanted to. And I was going to be home alone. And I was like, I deserve it. And that, when they talk about in the book how you start, you know, you go back to where you were and worse, I intended to have a glass of wine and paint my toes. And intend, or a bottle, back up. I had never intended on having a glass of wine, but I'm going to drink this bottle of wine and be done. And I was at the liquor store waiting for it to sell liquor to me at 6 a.m. the next day. And it, you know, spiraled out of control at that point. The next couple years are just a blur. You know, I was in and out of rehabs, medical detoxes. I'd get sober for 1 week, come home. You know, I had it all together now, you know. I thought the recovery process, I thought everything was so lame, and I couldn't, the thought of not drinking for the rest of my life, as soon as they started saying that, I was like, I'm out. Like, I need someone to teach me, I need to sober up, and then I need someone to teach me to drink like a lady, okay? Like, where can I find that in recovery? And it didn't work out. You know, my kids started, you know, moved to other houses. You know, I still had my daughter, my youngest daughter, and I'm partying. It's not partying. I was alone drinking by myself. I wouldn't call that partying. And, my son came home from college, and he came in to talk to me, and he came up to me, and he's like, Mom, I'm watching you die, and you have no soul. When I look at you, I look right through you. Your eyes aren't pretty and blue anymore, they're black, and I'm really scared, Mom. And I was so numb, and I just remember looking and being like, I should be able to generate a tear. But can you take me to the store before you leave so I don't have to walk? And, you know, that's where my disease takes me, where, you know, no human power, no one loves their kids more than me. And I would give my life right now for them, but I couldn't stop drinking for them, you know. No way. He's the one who, which to me, no 18-year-old kid should have to do this, found CVRS and got the balls rolling, all that rolling. I had gotten evicted. I stayed in my house till the last possible minute. And then I was homeless. A few weeks before, my parents came and got my youngest daughter. And I like kind of pretended to be sad, but the truth of the matter was that she was in my way, you know. I had to like make dinner for her and stuff. And so I had to like stay somewhat lucid until after dinner, and that really sucked, you know. They took her, and I was homeless. I was living in my car at Plaza because I thought that was the safest place. And I was drinking two gallons of vodka every 24 hours. I was the kind of alcoholic where if I passed out and then woke up, I was shaking. And I gave up. I didn't care anymore. I would just pray, God, take me or help me. Like, someone do. I don't know. I don't know what to do. I started stealing. I had quite a gig, by the way. So I still had food stamps, even though I had no house and I had no kids. So I had kind of a lot. So I would go to Save Mart, and I'm like, they just think I'm just a housewife. Okay, I had dreads in this side of my head because I wasn't brushing my hair or anything, you know. I had a broken flip-flop that I had gotten, like, a piece of stick in the bottom and, like, put it through, so I'm, like, limping around Save Mart. Yes, I'm sure they think that you're just a housewife. And I would go, and I would, like, stock up on, like, expensive food, like shrimp and things that looked expensive, and I had a big bag, and I would put the vodka in there, big gallons, and then go through the self-checkout. And it all canceled out because I had made some other homeless friends out there, and I would feed them. And I'd be like, everyone, I was like the Robin Hood of Plaza. It was like, here, you're like, I robbed the store, but, you know, and it all canceled out in my head, you know. I'm like, here, have some shrimp. It just was sick, right? And they're like, there's Christy, you know. And I remember a really low point was one guy came riding up, and he's like, I brought something to share. And he had this, like, weird decanter. I don't know, remind me of something, like, that you would have in, like, your science class, whatever. And it was filled with, like, homemade something. And he's like, I'll share with you. And when he turned his head, I downed it. I'm like, I just stole homemade alcohol from a homeless person. It's just ridiculous. So God started working in my life, and a bed opened up, and my family thought that I was going to fight going, because I always had before, and I just was like, take me right now. I will go right now. I crawled in there, and I was like, someone help me. I was so broken physically, mentally, spiritually. I was a shell of a person, you know, and I would love to say that I just jumped in and started doing steps, and I just knew, I finally conceded that I was an alcoholic, and my life was unmanageable. I definitely, for sure, was that. So step one was easy for me, and I knew I needed help, and I just tell me what to do. I was just crying. Just tell me what to do. And I just started getting in my Bible. So that came, spirituality came to me first. When people ask me what the difference is this time, is that I found God again. And I started praying and started believing and having faith. Because no human power could help me, you know, if that was the case, I would be sober, you know. When I was like 6 weeks sober, my dad took me to church in Fresno, and he had been ranting and raving about this church, and I still had some pretty big resentment, so I'm like, I have to be in the car with him for an hour, there and back, and my dad's a real reserved man, very private. When we would go to church and be a newcomer, he's like, we're sitting in the back, and no one raised their hand, and no one fill out those cards, and I don't want anyone coming to my business, and, you know, no one wants to get money from me, and also was raised in the Midwest, and he talked to this church he found. I have no idea. And we get there, and it's like a mega church, like hundreds of people, and it's an all black, like, gospel church. And I'm like, my dad? Okay. And we walk up, and everyone knows him. They're like, Jerry, is this Chris? They know me. They're like, is this Christy? Oh my God, we've been praying for you. And I'm just like, I don't know what's happening right now. And I'm still like barely, I mean, I'm probably not even really sober. And 6 weeks later, and a lady stops me and says, we've been praying for you. We've been meeting with your dad. He has been coming every Sunday for a year, sitting in the front row with his hands up crying. And I was like, my dad? Okay. And so we finally reached out to him, and we're just so happy you're here. So he wants to introduce me to the pastor, and we can't find him. So we sit, and he sits in the middle, and there's hundreds of people. There's this band going, and people are yelling out, you know, sing it, George, and hallelujah, like you see on TV. And I'm just tripping out that my dad likes this church, for one. The pastor comes out, and he's like 6'8". He's huge. Side note, I used to party with him in college. He changed his life around before me. I'm like, oh my God, I know the pastor. But anyways, so he starts, after they sing, he starts his, you know, preaching, and he looks out and he sees my dad. Sees me, and he's like, we're going to do something different. And he called the band back up, and they started playing a song, and he comes walking out, and he's like eyeing me, you know, and because I'm self-centered and have a big ego, I'm like, no, because I've been in uncomfortable positions before where I thought I was picked out of a crowd, like George Strait. He picked me. I'll be up there. And it was like this really cute little girl. So I'm like, okay, no, like, certainly he's not, like, choosing me, you know. And he did. He, like, walked straight to me, called me to the middle. And he just bear hugged me. He took his speaker off and just started praying in my ear. And I surrendered at that moment. I don't know what the man said or what the music was playing. And it was like 10 minutes. And I felt the weight of the world lift from me at that moment. And I heard God said to me, I have this, Christy. Be still and listen. And everything's going to be okay. And when I sat back down, then he just put his thing on, went back up and started where he left off. Actually, everyone clapped. It was just really a weird it was kind of a surreal experience. I had like that spiritual, like they talk about in the book, like the lightning bolt one, you know? And from that, I never looked back from that moment on. I just felt like the weight of the world was lifted. My answer is that I found God and I surrendered and I gave it to him. And I listened. I was open-minded and willing. And I just listened. I spent my time at New Hope in the book, the big book, in the Bible. I did, I didn't take any passes. I was serious. It was life or death for me. And it was my last chance at life. And I decided I wanted to live. And I wanted it for me. Like, in spite, if my kids never come back to me and hate me forever, I still have to do this, you know? I got a sponsor who's here. And I was in sober living at that point. I became on fire for the steps, and they worked for me. I was like, I got to give them a chance. I have nothing to lose, you know? The biggest thing for me, the two biggest things, is staying spiritually fit, giving it to God, not worrying. And that's when those promises started coming true for me. Promises that I didn't think would ever happen again. I never thought that I would be standing here. I had just accepted that that's just the way I was going to be, that I was going to die out there. And I was like kind of okay with it. Like, I didn't care anymore. I started caring. You know, I started caring. I could look myself in the mirror again. And when I did, I was like, oh, shit. I have not been looking in the mirror, obviously. I was like, oh, my God. I literally had to cut the tangles out of my hair, like, way up. That's why all this is all short. Because, I have two black eyes. I had fallen. I mean, it was really bad and ugly, you know. It was not a good scene. I was really embarrassed, and I never understood when people said I'm a grateful alcoholic. I'd be like, how are you grateful for this bullshit? Like, I ruin people's lives, you know, and as I started to become the woman that I was meant to be with God, I am grateful that I went through that, because before I was drinking alcoholically, I was miserable, you know, and I wasn't living the life. I wasn't, you know, walking in the spirit of the Lord. You know, I started like learning to be a lady again, you know, learning to be nice and kind. And, you know, people would tell me, oh, you're selfish. Even I would read it in the book and be like, I'm a special ed teacher. We are not selfish. I fought everything they said in here. And guess what? Everything in here is me, you know? Yeah, I mean, everything in here is me, you know? And it was when I stopped fighting it, found God, turn it over to God, and I turn everything over to God. And if I don't, you know, because I'm human, or I have a busy day and I don't pray, I'm in prayer most of the day, I'm like squirrely, like I'm like irritable and discontent, you know? Things, you know, don't really go my way. And I start getting pissed about that. And then I have to, you know, stand back and be like, wait, go give it to God. Go meditate. Meditate? Okay, be alone in my thoughts for longer than like 30 seconds. You should have seen me the first time I meditated. I was just like, oh, you know, like, and now I meditate. I don't do it every day, but, you know, 4 to 5 times a day, 30 minutes. And I look forward to it. And I did it today because I was nervous for tonight. And I was like, okay, you know, get guided meditation on, you grow when you do those things. That I had to be open-minded and willing to believe and have faith in God, but also other people, that these people that have, you know, paved the path before us know more than me, you know, like that was really hard for me to accept because I know everything. But once I just listened and did that, you know, my life started turning around. And today, you know, I'm not just sober, I'm free. And I'm at peace and I have serenity. I am a good role model for my kids. They're back in my life. I pray with my kids when they have a problem. We pray, and I'm living it and walking it, so it's not just lip service, you know, like, oh, give it to God. You know, no, let's sit down and pray. You know, let's give it to God. He has a plan for you. And I believe that. And so with that, I guess that's it. I'll keep coming back. Do I talk long enough?